Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Wednesday, the 19th of March, the feast of
St. Joseph.
Yeah, thank you very much. Just wanted to remind you. Patrick gets all the Joseph. It's not a bad feast day either. There's some
my
good food.
It's my confirmation name.
Yes. So well, there you go. We're brothers then. Excellent.
As Fred looks up at the ceiling, making sure the lightning bolt doesn't come down.
We're that's we've been insulated from that a long time ago. There's lightning rods all over this studio. We never know. Welcome. Good morning. Hello, all. It is lovely to have you with us on this very sunny and beautiful morning, and hopefully it is where you are as well. We have a terrific group of individuals who are in the studio to talk about the items on our docket, and we will get to that just a moment. We always welcome you to be a part of it. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Let me introduce the group to you. We welcome former New York 19th Congressman and New York Assemblyman John Faso. Hello, John. How are you?
I'm well. Great to be with you and your audience and our panelists here today. And a little colder out this morning than I was hoping for, but I think spring is definitely in the air. You can feel it. You can hear the birds chirping, and we have no shortage of topics to discuss.
No, we have a lot to discuss, and it's always wonderful having you here, and we appreciate you being here, and thank you very much. Yes, that was one of the first things Nick said. It felt like it was still spring-ish.
Second fake spring.
Yeah.
We're not out of the winter weather, but it's getting there, and it's exciting.
Nick Rangel is Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York. Always good to see you. How are you?
It's really great to see you as well, and fun new tidbit. Views expressed here are my own and not of Lasny.
Did you have a meeting?
I did.
I'm sorry we caused that.
No, it's wonderful. And we're really thrilled to be here and to be involved with the roundtable, and we appreciate it.
Yes, okay. We all understand, I think. Yes, we all understand. Thank you, Nick. We also welcome diplomat in residence. That's not true, actually.
Not anymore.
That's an old.
Not anymore. That's an old title.
Now with the Bard
Center for Civic Engagement.
Bard Center for Civic Engagement, and you are certainly you certainly know that subject, and you an ambassador, and it's wonderful to have you on the program.
My pleasure to be here, Joe, with you and my distinguished colleagues.
Thank you very much for being here, as always. And the Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin, joins us. Good morning, Bob. How are you?
Good, Joe. It's Nick, my opinions are my own and sometimes don't even represent my own. I wonder. Joe, today is also National Aardvark Day, so I think that's something we could all get together on.
What are we supposed to do about that?
Hug an aardvark.
Okay. All right. Well,
especially if he's named Joseph.
Yes. The St. Joseph, the aardvark.
Yeah, you can do it all at once.
That's right.
The saintly St. Joseph aardvark. Right?
Well, that's good. I wouldn't mind an aardvark named after Joseph, because right now all we really have is aspirin.
Yeah, you really need to step it up.
St. Joseph's baby aspirin. So not bad stuff, by the way, but still. All right, let's get to what is going on in the world. And as soon as I can actually open my computer, we will get right to the topics at hand. I will say that, again, we remind you to be a part of the program, and we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. Okay, so legal scholars say the U.S. has reached a tipping point and that the question is not whether there is a constitutional crisis, but rather how much damage it will cause. This is the headline in the New York Times: defiance and threats in deportation case renew fear of a constitutional crisis. Over the weekend, the Trump administration ignored a federal judge's order not to deport a group of Venezuelan men, violating an instruction that could not have been plainer or more direct. Justice Department lawyers later justified the administration's actions with contentions that many legal experts said bordered on frivolous. The line between arguments in support of a claimed right to disobey court orders and outright defiance has become gossamer thin, they said, again raising the question of whether the latest clash between President Trump and the judiciary amounts to a constitutional crisis. I'm going to begin with you, John Faso, because we did talk about this topic yesterday, and one of the questions that I asked was, how do we know when we're in a constitutional crisis? Like, what is the criteria for that? And does it all varies on how we look at it, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, a lot of these terms have been, I think, overused in recent years.
Bandied about.
I don't think we're at a constitutional crisis. I do think that we're at some very interesting constitutional questions, however. And the deportation case of the Tren de Agua gang members is really one they'll be studying in law schools in years to come. And deliciously, it refers to the Alien Enemies Act of, get this, 1798 or 9. And it really is. It's a great question. I think that the president made a proclamation in which they were attempting to get around an aspect of that Alien Enemies Act, which basically requires a declaration of war by the Congress, which obviously has not been done. And the president's proclamation talked about the invasion of foreign adversaries into the United States. Now, the problem that he'll have with this is that many of these Venezuelan individuals subject to deportation actually came in under through flights that were authorized by the Biden administration a few years ago because of the political and domestic turmoil within Venezuela. The argument is, and there's strong evidence to show, that the Maduro government in Venezuela actually emptied some of their prisons and sent a lot of these bad guys into the United States on those flights. Now, the problem, I think, for the Trump administration is that the precedent here is not in his favor. The precedent says you have to have a declaration of war, and clearly we don't have that now. And trying to couch this as part of an enemy alien invasion, kind of extra national invasion, I think is going to be problematic. Now, did they pick a very sympathetic group of people to deport and put on planes? Absolutely. I mean, this is something where the average American thinking about this are going to say, yeah, get those guys out of here.
Right.
The problem they're going to have is that there will inevitably be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. A small number of people may have been erroneously taken up into this dragnet. And that's what the basis of the lawsuit is. I think the administration is going to have trouble. And I think the courts, because Judge Boasberg, despite all this kind of crazy talk about impeachment and everything else, Judge Boasberg is actually following the existing legal precedents in this regard. So,
but isn't that the problem? I mean, the case is the case, but isn't the problem the fact that the judge issued an order and it was ignored?
Well, what the Trump administration says is that he mentioned turn the planes around in his oral order, but when he wrote the order, he didn't say that. So that's one point that they're going to argue. I think ultimately, let's face it, the administration is seeking to enhance the executive authority over appointments, and that gets into the firing of Federal Trade Commission appointees who were Democrats. They're going to argue, and as the 90-year-old case of the executor, Humphrey's executor, as to the president's ability to fire appointees to these so-called independent agencies, whether that violates the Constitution. And ironically, as I said a few weeks ago, in this case, Trump is on the same side as Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who insisted about his authority to fire an independent agency, FTC, appointee, because he didn't like what the FTC was doing to block some of his New Deal approaches. So I think this is really, I wouldn't call it a constitutional crisis, back to your original point. I would call it a real constitutional question that now the administration is seeking, in these opening days of their new administration, they are seeking to bring this to a head. And I think ultimately it's going to wind up in the Supreme Court. And on some of these cases, I think the president will win. And on some of them, like these Venezuelan deportees, he may actually lose because the precedent is not with him.
I believe right now that if I wanted to plant peas, I could in the furrows of Bob's brow.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, I guess the question that I come back to is that what happens when the administration ignores a lawful direction from the courts? And I think that was a question that's at the heart of what we're talking about as a constitutional crisis. And when the judge says, "Don't do this," and you do it, you're ignoring the direction of the court. I'll also note that sometimes the most unsavory groups are the ones that are the cases that set some of the most important decisions in our history,
like the Nazis, exactly.
So set aside for a second how distasteful the group may be. The question that I think we need to talk through is what happens if you have an administration that ignores the direction of the courts, and what do we do about that? So what happens when you have someone like Tom Homan get on Fox News and basically say that he's going to ignore the direction of the court? That's what we're talking about right now is. How do we deal with that? And the point of where is it a crisis or not? I think the minute that you have someone working in government who knowingly violates the law and then is not punished, these are all steps towards a constitutional crisis. And I guess the main question that I have for the panel and for all of us is what happens when that occurs. If Congress isn't going to provide oversight and the courts say that some action of the executive is barred pending further review and those actions continue, what happens to our country?
Nick Rangel.
I mean, I 100% agree. I think there is a tremendous concern about how we think about the people whose rights are being violated and how we allow violations to occur against our most vulnerable populations. Because once you open the door to that precedent, then it's precedent. You can use it against other types of people. I think when we're alleging that the deportees were members of gangs, the argument that they don't need due process to prove that they're members of gangs and they don't deserve the opportunity to prove that they are not members of gangs raises a lot of concerns. I think they
also were already in custody.
Yes. We also know that U.S. born citizens have been held in custody because they are brown.
Yeah.
And have not been asked for ID when they've been rounded up, right? So there is also a possibility that some of the people being shipped to this mega prison that is currently holding 40,000 people with cells that hold up to 70 prisoners at a time, that is known for its egregious human rights violations. It's known for its death rate abuses and other really just awful conditions, is where we're sending people who have lived in the United States and in some cases for many years, who have families here who have been denied even the possibility of telling their kids where they're at.
Ambassador Fred Hoff.
Well, on this, Joe, on this issue of what's a constitutional crisis, how would you define it? I personally have a pretty high bar, and it's higher than the controversies we're going through right now. I would say that if the president defies a decision of the Supreme Court of the United States, then we definitely have a constitutional crisis. And at this point, I have no earthly idea how that gets resolved. As far as these Venezuelan nationals are concerned, I guess I'm willing to accept the assertion that they are indeed criminals who deserve to be gone from the United States. But technically speaking, and this goes to John's point, they're not. You know, they're neither an invading army, nor are they terrorists. These are garden variety criminals, maybe very violent, but they don't seem to have a political agenda at all. So I'm not even sure why the Enemy Aliens Act was used to justify this. John, perhaps you have an idea why that particular statute seems to be, from the administration's point of view, applicable in this case.
Because all the cool legislation was from 1798.
Right. Well, besides that fact, which makes it delightful to discuss, I think, Fred, the answer is they're using this because they believe, with the president's executive order and proclamation, mm-hmm. that this is actually an invasion fomented by a foreign power. And they're trying to build an argument under the that Enemy Aliens Act to justify this, because that would allow them to, if indeed they're found to be subject to the Alien Enemies Act, then you don't owe them due process. You don't owe them the normal constitutional standards. And this has only been invoked three times in our history. One was in the War of 1812, and the other was World War II. Yep. And I guess I forget now the third time. Maybe there was right at that point in 1800 or so, when you had all of this fear about French subversion, et cetera.
Yeah, but John Adams.
John Adams, et cetera. Yeah. You know, so I think that's exactly why they're going here. But I think the problem they're going to have, and I read a long piece by Andy McCarthy in National Review early this morning about this. And he, who's a conservative legal commentator, he doesn't believe this will hold up because he doesn't think you have the elements that are necessary. In the War of 1812, World War II, you had declarations of war. And so he really believes, and he argues, that Trump is not going to win this case in the Supreme Court, regardless of his executive proclamation. That being said, there's no finer group that Trump could have picked to win public approval, because the vast majority of the public, if you ask them a question, they could say, "Yeah, get these guys out of here."
But still, you see, what concerns me though is the Trump administration operates on very tenuous legal grounds. They act according to emotion and public opinion rather than law and order. They take an action that the courts then say, wait a second, hold on. They carry out the action regardless of the court's direction, and then what happens?
Well,
so basically, that to me is at its heart, that is a constitutional crisis, right?
Yeah, I think if we get to the point where they defy an order of the U.S. Supreme Court, I agree with Fred. That would be a constitutional crisis in my mind. In this instance, I don't think we're there. This is going to go through an appellate process. It may quickly wind up in the U.S. Supreme Court. And there's no doubt the administration is attempting to push the boundaries of what they as the executive are able to do. You see this with the FTC commissioners and certain firings that they've made there. But I think, you know, Trump was quite, look, people say, don't pay attention to what he says, pay attention to what they do. He did say yesterday that in some interview, I'm not sure where it was, that he would abide by an order of the courts, meaning the Supreme Court. So I think at the end of the day, we have to wait and see whether or not we're at that point, Bob, where you're talking about the crisis.
But let me ask both you and Fred one quick question, and I'll turn it back to you. Why the Supreme Court? There are. You're basically giving the executive branch the capacity to ignore the direction of the other courts. Why do you set that bar? I mean, and again, if Biden did this, people would have been losing their mind.
Well, of course, and look, my own belief is that the executive branch, the president. Should comply with court orders. Court orders he doesn't like, instead of calling for a judge's impeachment, he needs to appeal to the next level. I focus on the word crisis, okay? I don't think most Americans would believe that right now, you know, notwithstanding all of the unpleasantness, that we are in crisis mode. I think that would change if President Trump defies a Supreme Court decision that goes against him.
I'm sorry.
Like, it's on the edge. I think people are paying attention. They're sensitive to the issue. Yeah. They're thinking about it. But I would agree, we're not yet in a crisis because we're waiting to see what happens next. And there's so many steps between here and crisis.
And I think some could credibly argue that Biden ignored orders of the Supreme Court when it came to the student loan program that he unilaterally adopted, deferral of student loan obligations that was not authorized by Congress. And he went against that directly.
I don't want to go off on a tangent on this, and I'm not arguing this point with you, only that it's been brought up a couple times in the show, and I've read into this. That my understanding, the difference there was that they did something different. The court ruled on student loans, and then they went and did another order.
They found another provision
of law.
They
found another provision of law.
Yeah.
I mean, that is, I understand that, but it is different, right?
It's not the same as turn the plane around and then just not doing that.
Right. I'm not arguing with Matt. Yeah. I've heard that argument, and I'm just curious as to, I mean, I realize it's maybe even a fine line, maybe not, but it just seems to me that they went back, okay, that's your argument. Now, try this one on for size.
Yeah, that's right.
Which is what everyone does.
Well, I just think that it was that ultimately, in this instance, I mean, I wouldn't describe what Biden did as a quote unquote crisis either. A constitutional crisis.
Oh no, I agree with you.
Okay,
I agree with you. I
think they basically flaunted the obvious direction of the Supreme Court on the student lending moratoriums that they came up with. But in this instance, if the president, if this case gets to the Supreme Court, where I believe it will, and some of these other cases like the appointment power, I don't believe Trump will defy an order of the U.S. Supreme Court. And if he does, I think that would be a crisis.
So let me ask you one more question, and you alluded to it very early in your response at the beginning of our conversation, and that is with the president then talking about impeachment and being scolded by the Chief Justice. I mean, that sort of adds to this idea of crisis because you're going after this judge. You're getting reprimanded by the Chief Judge of the United States Supreme Court.
I think it's bad, and this goes on both sides. It's really bad for our system when politicians attack judges for carrying out their duties, and the kind of the flagrant misuse of the term impeachment is really ridiculous. And I see that some Republican member of Congress introduced a resolution of impeachment on Judge Boasberg. I mean, that's just absurd and ridiculous. And we should get off of this tangent. It really is not helpful, and it kind of distorts what the constitutional process was. So I think Justice Roberts' admonition yesterday was well taken, and I think Republicans and Democrats who disagree with a court decision shouldn't go out like Chuck Schumer did outside the U.S. Supreme Court and say, you know, threaten cut certain justices. Oh, there's going to be a whirlwind. You'll reap the whirlwind if you decide the wrong way on the abortion case. I think that's equally wrong.
Yeah, I'm happy to see in that regard. My favorite newspaper, the Wall Street Journal, taking a strong editorial position on all of this. Something that I think reflects actual conservative values. The Journal is saying Mr. Trump's line that this judge didn't win an election is especially misguided. Under the Constitution, the judiciary is a co-equal branch of government. Federal judges don't run for office, but they have lifetime tenure so they can maintain their independence from the political passions of the day. This is from the Wall Street Journal. Not exactly a progressive leftist outlet, but something that's genuinely conservative and sees some threats to our constitutional order.
Fred, you're absolutely right. The Journal is correct, and carrying that further, that's why it was wrong, I think, for Democrats to say, "Oh, we don't like decision overturning Roe v. Wade. Let's expand the Supreme Court. Let's change."
Well, and left, this may well be an example of chickens coming home to roost.
I
wish I had a dollar, even less than a dollar, for every time I've heard over the past few years, sometimes on this show, that the Supreme Court is illegitimate because of some of its rulings, like overturning Roe v. Wade. In our system, you win some and you lose some when the judiciary exercises its Article III powers. And trying to burn down the system when you lose is not the way to uphold our Constitution.
I'm sorry, I got to say that I do think this court's illegitimate, Fred. I think the corruption from some of its members, the gifts that they have taken, the gifts that absolutely I think have influenced decisions. I think this court is rife with corruption and illegitimacy. So I will tell you.
Strictly speaking, though, illegitimacy means that we are under no obligation to obey its decisions.
That's right.
I mean, we've had attacks on the legitimacy of our system, from Donald Trump when he said Barack Obama was not entitled to be president because he was born God knows where, when he said he actually won the 2020 election. And we've had attacks on legitimacy from the left. That doesn't like some of the Supreme Court justices or doesn't like some of the decisions. There's just a remarkable convergence here, and I think it's bad for all of us. I think it's bad for our system.
Can I just make a distinction, though? It's one thing for Democrats to scold SCOTUS for its decision. It's another thing for DOJ to actually file a motion for the removal of a judge and need for the Chief Justice to come in and say, no, we don't do that here. We can't compare those two things. One is a political statement, which is what politicians do, and the other is an affirmative action to engage in the removal of a duly seated judge.
Fair point. Good point. We're going to take a break at that, and when we come back, we'll continue the conversation. Going well so far. All right. We'll continue. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.
Kimberly.
And now we bring on the letters. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Wednesday, the 19th of March. Edie says, if it goes to the Supreme Court, Trump loaded the Supreme Court with sycophants. Do you really think they will rule against him?
They've routinely ruled against him in his first term. And, you know, again, Edie, you got to take a look at the number of instances they've actually, you know, ruled against actions the administration has taken. So I have no doubt that they'll do the right thing at the right time.
Ed says the crisis, quote unquote, actually began last July when the Roberts Court threw out the Constitution and awarded the executive unprecedented immunity.
No, I don't think it was unprecedented, but, you know, they made it clear that presidents can't be hampered in their official duties by litigation, but that he still remains civilly liable for actions that fall outside his presidential authority.
Nick, you wanted in on that as well.
I was agreeing.
Okay, agreeing.
Yeah,
agreeing.
I mean that was look. That was a I disagreed with the substance of the decision, but you know, as an American, I have no doubt that this is the law of the land. Several years ago, 70 years ago, when the Supreme Court issued Brown versus Board of Education, the outcry. In this country, mainly coming from segregationists, about the illegitimacy of the Supreme Court, and this decision was overwhelming. But
impeach Earl Warren. Impeach
Earl Warren. According to our system, this is the law of the land, whether we agree with it or not.
Fred, I'm sorry. Bob?
Nope, I was...
Okay, yeah. All right. Deanne says there seems to be... I'm telling you, please wear your name tags. Deanne says there seems to be a lot of whataboutism today. Well, the Democrats did this, blah, 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 blah. So what? How about talking about what's happening now, which is much more serious? Well, I think we are doing that, right? I mean, I think we're bringing that into...
And context is important, too. I mean, I think it's valuable to have some compare and contrast. Like, you could point out how, sure, the Democrats scolded the justices, but they didn't call for them to be removed from office. Those are two different things. I think it's important.
But I think it raises, though, an interesting point that we should spend a little bit of time on, Joe, and that's what happens if we do have a situation where the executive branch does not follow the direction of the courts. What do we do? Like, what are the safeguards in that situation? What are the safeguards if the Department of Justice doesn't follow the direction of a judge? What should happen in that situation? And these are conversations you wish you hope never to have to have or to carry out. But I think these are conversations that, as a society, we should be starting to have, because there are certainly trend lines that point to a willingness to ignore the directions.
Well, so what's your answer? My assumption, I guess, is that states sort of step in and fill that void in some ways.
How?
Well, we have our own. Militaries, for example. We have our own police forces. We have our own laws. You can, for example, at the federal level, declare there are only two genders in the country, but in New York State, that's not the case, right? So there are some provisions that kind of provide protection to New Yorkers that can shield it from federal action.
So are you advocating that the deployment
I'm not advocating
of the National
anything.
Guard to, I mean, and this is, and I think this is what concerns me.
On behalf of Nick or Lasby, right. She's not advocating anything. Right.
But I mean, and I'm sorry to put you in a tough spot like that, I think this is a legitimate question of...
Well, it is, right? So people in New York who have various immigration statuses, they're citizens of New York and also of the United States, or they are residents of New York and also legal residents residents of the United States. And I think there are things that states can do to protect its own residents, its own citizens in various ways. And I think New York does a lot of those kinds of activities where people, when they leave the state, have fewer protections or fewer rights, but inside of the state have more protections, more rights. I think, and we're seeing that there's like a patchwork of counties that are engaging in, you know, more proactive relations with ICE. They're using ICE to sort of circumvent bail reform laws in counties across the state. In other counties, they're using local laws to create sanctuaries. And I think that patchwork will come into play. I think it's an important part of that bigger question.
But what happens, though, when ICE agents raid in the middle of the night, take somebody out of New York State, fly them out, court says, wait a second, and ICE says, no, the plane, we're not turning the planes around. I mean, what then as a society do we do? Do we just sort of shrug it up and say, oh, okay, well, I mean, we just missed the boat on that. I mean, to me, there should be punishment for the agents involved in that activity. There needs to be safeguards put in place, and these are really uncomfortable conversations. But as a society, we're in a different place than we were.
I hesitantly ask you what type of punishments you would argue for.
If you knowingly violate the order of the courts, I would argue that you should be held in contempt of court.
Sure. Yeah.
Fred?
Yeah, I was about to say I'm not an attorney, but the first thing that comes to mind if a decision at some level is defied is what powers does the judge have to haul people in and find them in contempt? Ultimately, I think these key issues do rise to the Supreme Court, and I think this is the strategy of the Trump administration. Is to get these, and I'm told there are five issues. Very quickly, one: does a peacetime president have the power to deport non-citizens under the Wartime Alien Enemies Act, as we discussed earlier? That's a key question. Two: should a single federal judge in a district court have the power to block a president's deportation program nationwide? Three: can that federal judge's order extend to international waters and demand that a plane full of deportees turn around in the middle of the flight? Fourth, does a green card holder, like this Columbia student, have rights that protect him from deportation, or can the Secretary of State unilaterally declare that this person is a threat to American foreign policy? And finally, can the Secretary of State's power to deport immigrants based on foreign policy concerns extend to so many student visa holders that some colleges won't be able to admit foreign exchange students? These are the five issues that I think the Trump administration wants to elevate at some point to the Supreme Court. It obviously has some confidence it's going to prevail in the Supreme Court. Like John, I don't share that confidence, at least on some of these issues.
Yeah,
I feel like I'm in class.
I think they've got a difficult. I'm not sure of all the numbered items that you had there, Fred, but I would say that I think they're going to have a difficult time upholding the use of the Alien Enemies Act in the Supreme Court in this particular instance. And I think that the authority of the Secretary of State to deport people who are here on student visas or even green card holders will have a little higher threshold of rights in the United States. But I think the authority of the Secretary of State will be upheld in that instance. And I think really when it comes down to some of the questions we're dealing with in terms of the funding from Congress, where it's dealing with something that's strictly domestic and you have direction from Congress as to domestic spending, I think it's pretty clear cut that the administration will have a hard time overturning a direct congressional directive relating to spending. However, where it deals like the USAID, with something that implicates the president's constitutional power over foreign policy, it's not as clear a question. And I think there the president may prevail at the Supreme Court. So I think in all of these instances, again, these are going to be the topics that will be studied by law professors and law students going forward for many years. It's going to be extremely interesting to see whether the doctrine, the 90-year-old doctrine of Humphrey's executor, survives in this context, because the argument will be that the president of the United States is vested with all executive authority under the Constitution. And when you have agencies like the FTC, which have both executive and legislative regulatory authority, that line gets blurred. So I don't know what's going to happen when Humphrey's executor comes up again before the Supreme Court. But that's clearly happening. And Fred, you're absolutely right. The administration is pushing these things early because they want to get a resolution on some of these questions where they think the executive authority has been diminished. And I think, frankly, on some of them they'll win and some they won't.
Let's go through some letters here real quick. Let's see. We go to John Ambassador. Fred Hoff says he is, quote, willing to accept the deported Venezuelans are criminals. What? Why? There was no hearing, no due process, and they are not just being deported. They are being sent into a nightmarish gulag. This is not acceptable.
Yeah, I'm simply willing to assume, and I may be incorrect in my assumption, that these are not particularly good guys.
Craig writes, suggesting that we can ignore all judges' decisions until the Supreme Court makes a decision is not only incredibly wrong, it is incredibly dangerous. Why? Because journalists are enemies of the state, according to many Republicans, and they belong to these gangs that follow the president around the country. What gang, quote unquote, is next?
Well, it gets into one of Fred's numbered points, the question of the authority of a single federal judge in a single federal judicial district to impose a nationwide injunction over actions that the executive may take or the federal government may take. And that's been something that has gotten a lot of attention from certain members of the Supreme Court in recent years. And it's an open question as to how that authority works.
I can't believe, says Scott, how naive the panel sounds, quote, waiting to see whether we're in a crisis. You've read Project 2025. You've seen what Trump and Musk have done so far. You may have seen coverage about Trump's alarming connections to Putin and the KGB going back to the 1980s. The news every day gets more terrifying as they push the bounds further and further and further. If you don't think it's a crisis yet, you're steering us toward making sure it becomes an even worse one. Thanks for your work.
I mean, I think it's really important to stay grounded and to stay focused on the like tangible impacts of what is happening and not happening at the federal level and across the country. And there's a lot of reasons. One is that real problems get lost in the noise. So if we're just constantly allowing the flood of deplorable behavior to distract us from real tangible problems, then we miss the opportunity to have a true impact on what actually matters. What actually matters may differ for different people, but being upset about tweets to me is not what really matters. It's the 10-year-old who is a U.S. citizen who was held in terrible conditions immediately after having brain surgery and then deported to a foreign country that she's never been to. That matters. That has a tangible impact on our citizenry. And to me, sifting through the noise is really crucial right now and in this moment.
Yeah, it just strikes me that, between the MAGA right and the progressive left, there is one fundamental area of agreement that we are in a crisis, and that major parts of our constitutional system are illegitimate, and this is a real danger when you've got the extremes on both sides, which seem to be growing numerically, converging. on the illegitimacy of our constitutional system.
Two letters, and then we'll take a break. Lucia says they haven't even been proved to be gang members. These various deportations are illegal and terribly frightening in the implications for all Americans. Don't quote to us the silly arguments by this mendacious administration. 10 points to Lucia for using the word mendacious.
That's a good one.
Jay writes, the Venezuelans flown out of the country were criminals. The January 6th rioters were terrorists. And now they're home cleaning their guns for the next time. Trump, they're waiting for the next time Trump is voted out of office. We'll hold there. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll move on to other topics with our brilliant panel, and we welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org, a few messages, and then news with Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this March 19th, John Faso was here, former New York 19th Congressman and New York Assemblyman, Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin. Ambassador Fred Hoff joins us, and Nick Rangel, Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York. Welcome all, and thank you for being here. We're going to move on to new topics. President Vladimir Putin agreed Tuesday to halt strikes on Ukrainian energy infrastructure after a lengthy conversation with President Donald Trump, a first step toward easing Russia's war on Ukraine, but he appeared resistant to the fuller ceasefire championed by the U.S. leader and endorsed by Kyiv. The limited agreement showed the difficulty Trump may have in bringing to a close the war in Ukraine, despite a campaign promise to do so in, quote, 24 hours. Still, the Kremlin embraced the broader conversation with Trump as a signal that it was being welcomed back into the club of global superpowers, despite its years-long campaign to capture neighbors' territory, undermine democratic elections, and make common cause with U.S. foes in Beijing and Tehran. Bob Griffin.
Yeah, I'll also note that last night both Ukraine and Russia, it's being publicized about the attacks that occurred. So understand that whatever agreement was made was pretty thin. I think Putin played Trump. I really do. I think that he didn't really agree to anything. He agreed to halt or at least, I guess, halt, limit the attacks on the energy infrastructure. The attacks weren't as effective, and frankly, going into spring, so you've got the attacks don't hurt as badly as they did going into winter. And certainly this has been a target of the Russians. I'll go back to sort of, again, I am really troubled the fact that this administration is won't come out and say that the fault of this war rests with Russia. Okay, Russia invaded Ukraine, and we're sort of whitewashing that fact. I also worry that we're playing into Putin's hands things like deleting the information about the number of Ukrainian children that have been stolen and kidnapped and taken into Russia. I don't understand where we're going with this, but if I were Ukraine, I would be really, really concerned, because Putin's position actually was even more aggressive than what you were talking about, Joe, is that he was seeking ceasefire. He was seeking land that the Russians don't even occupy. So he's looking for a bigger grab right now, which tells me that he does not think that we have the strength or the coalition no longer has the strength to combat him. I'll also say to you that we would be remiss as a panel not to talk about the issue of what we've done to our own alliances, and the fact that we were stronger and our national security was stronger when we were in alliance with our allies than we are today. I think we are fundamentally weaker today, and it showed in the negotiations.
Nick.
Yeah, I think there's a phone call planned for shortly this morning between the president and Ukraine, and it sounds like Putin is kind of doing a bit of a celebratory walk around Russia after his call with Trump, because he has just completely declared that he's not interested in Trump's proposal, and he instead put his own proposal on the table. And I think everyone saw this coming, so I don't think there are any surprises. From my perspective, anyway.
John?
Well, I've been dismayed, to put it mildly, at a number of the things President Trump has said about the Ukraine-Russia war in recent months and recent days. I'm reminded, though, of the president is attempting to bring about peace, and I think we can all agree that that would be good. The terms of that, however, are where the rubber hits the road. And I'm reminded that the last four U.S. presidents on both parties have basically tried, whether it was George W. Bush saying he'd looked into Putin's soul, or Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama pulling out the reset button on negotiations, or Obama turning another eye when Assad crossed the red line and used chemical weapons and allowed the Russians basically in to construct a naval base in Syria, and their military base there actively assisting Assad in killing his own people. And I'm reminded, so I think that Trump is and Biden also had a lot of mistakes dealing with whether this was going to be a minor encroachment or minor incursion into Ukraine before the Russians actually invaded. The thing that I'm reminded of is the cartoon after George W. Bush said that he looked into the soul of Putin. It was Bush and Putin sitting there, and Bush says he's looked into Putin's soul. And Putin is looking back wide-eyed, and both eyes, it says the letters KGB. We cannot trust Vladimir Putin. He's a liar. He's a murderer. He's a thief. He's disreputable in every sense. That doesn't mean we shouldn't try to negotiate something, but I think we have to be really cautious, and Trump needs to be very, very cautious about what concessions he can wring out of the Russians, because right now it's looking awfully one-sided against the Ukrainians. And I have utmost respect for the Ukrainian determination to fight off the Russians and to preserve their national identity, which Putin wants to extinguish.
John, do you think who in Congress is trying to push that agenda that you just spoke, because it does not seem like this is the agenda of the administration. But my sense is that there's a growing unease in both the Senate and the House about what's going
there
on.
Is.
But
there is.
What's
there,
happening?
There are a number of people like Brian Fitzpatrick and Don Bacon in the House, yeah. Mitch McConnell in the Senate, and others who are, you know, really expressing to the administration their concern and opposition to caving into Putin on this. Now, I think they're trying to do that privately so as not to to leave their doors open to be able to send those messages. But I think we're in a very dangerous period right now.
I do think also this is really important for the Trump administration to get right, or to start getting more right. Just like he's come out so strong with so many statements and sort of celebrating wins that haven't materialized. And this is a moment where he's got to be more circumspect, because he's losing confidence in his ability to actually get agreement here because of the way he talks about this and makes it such a sort of circus.
Fred.
I think I have to admit, my first reaction after reading everything I could find about this 2.5-hour telephone conversation yesterday, my first reaction centered on diplomatic best practices. Last week, the United States basically summoned Ukraine to Saudi Arabia. to agree to an American ceasefire deal. Yesterday, Presidents Trump and Putin were on the telephone, and I would have thought, you know, President Trump saying, you know, Vlad, here's the deal. The Ukrainians have agreed to it. How about you? Can we expect you to agree? And of course, we know that Putin backpedaled and danced and did a bunch of rope-a-dope and came up with this idea of a much more limited ceasefire. Well, what was it exactly that compelled the President of the United States to agree to this? Why would he not have said at some point, President Putin, in all frankness, in all sincerity, I'm going to have to insist that you agree to our proposal. It's clear you're not there yet. Let's reconvene on the phone in a week and see if you're ready to sign up to this. Click. What's the hurry? What is the merit in being in such a hurry to discard your own position and accept something something a lot less? I was reading this morning one of my favorite columnists, David Ignatius, and here's how he puts it. Trump has put himself on the diplomatic hot seat. He's promised the world a peace agreement, but the path toward that laudable goal has a sharp fork ahead. Trump will either confront Putin and get concessions that could frame a lasting deal, or he'll back off and risk a bad deal that might only be a temporary pause in this terrible war. I think David's right.
Yeah, I think Ignatius's analysis is correct. And there's a political risk here for Trump, because while the support among Republicans for Ukraine's position has diminished somewhat, it actually has increased among Republicans in public polling in recent days. And Trump has a number of economic means by which he can really put pressure on Putin. I mentioned this last month, one of which is the price of oil. Driving down the price of oil worldwide would put real economic pressure on the Russians. And there are other things that can be done. One kind of silver lining in the ally business that Bob had raised justifiably is that finally the Germans are actually saying they're going to be able to borrow the resources to build up their defenses. And they have been pathetic. And some of the other allies have been pathetic, notable exceptions being the Baltic states, Poland, Denmark, and Holland have all been stalwart in this regard, as has Great Britain. So we're finally seeing some real commitment by the Germans to rearm and to build their military capacity, which is long overdue. So that's something that is losing some of the American protective umbrella is now forcing some of the Europeans to do what they really need to be doing.
But all of that takes time. How does that help the people being, you know, literally displaced from their homes in
Ukraine?
You're
right. It does take time.
It's like a multi-year strategy.
It does take time, but it's best to start now. They should have started 5 years ago.
And but two things can happen at the same time. We could continue to support and use our resources to protect Ukrainians
totally agree.
Also work with Europe
The United States is still the United States is still indispensable in all of this. And our Secretary of State has acknowledged this, Marco Rubio. He said there's no way to have an enduring peace without the deterrence piece being part of it. Secretary of State needs to convince the commander in chief that this is the case.
But then you've got the vice president going out and insulting Poland and insulting the Netherlands and insulting the United Kingdom. You know, the president is making comments about making Canada a state, putting troops into Greenland, retaking by force the Panama Canal. I mean, our foreign affairs right now are a mess. And
I think a lot of what Trump says is really intemperate in that regard. I would note that recently a major U.S. investment firm announced they were purchasing the port rights from the Hong Kong-based firm on either side of the Panama Canal.
Yep.
And, you know, it's I think that's it's curious that that's happening now, and that's a good thing. But the bottom line here is that we have to keep in mind Putin's ambition, like Catherine the Great and Peter the Great, was to extend their hegemony over a broader area. He still believes in the reconstitution of the Russian Empire. He said the greatest tragedy of the 20th century was the dismemberment of the Soviet Union. So all of these things, we should take what the guy says. He wrote right before the Ukrainian war started, where before he started that invasion, the most recent invasion, he basically said the Ukrainian identity doesn't exist, right, that it should be extinguished. And this is reminiscent of what Stalin did to the Ukrainians in the Great Hunger in the 1930s. He literally killed about 5 million Ukrainians through starvation. Yeah. So Putin is no different. This guy is a thug. He's a murderer. And yes, we do have to deal with him, but we should deal with him from a position of strength. Yep. And one of the problems, you know, yes, you mentioned, Nick, that the Germans, and that takes time on rearmament. We are also woefully lacking in terms of our own military industrial base to produce the weaponry that we need. Bob knows this probably better than anyone.
But John, how do we, I mean, in everything you say, I don't disagree with. I'm trying to reconcile your what you just said with this current administration's policy in the silence from the majority party in this country right now. And this is where I'm really struggling.
Yeah, I share your frustration. I wish more Republicans were more vocal. But again, I think that Trump is pursuing a strategy. He thinks he can get a deal. The last four U.S. presidents, Democrat and Republican, right, yeah, thought they could get deals. Yeah. And they weren't able with this guy. And if Trump is able to get a deal with him, you know, mazel tov, let a thousand flowers bloom. I just doubt that under these circumstances, unless we show a willingness to continue to arm Ukraine, to continue to provide them with the intelligence that they need, and to continue to work with our allies to build up their military industrial capacity while doing the same with our own, that our threats will be not credible.
And you just put something in, Fred. You know what? The other piece that Trump should have said is, if that's your answer, then just let you know, then we're shipping more HIMARS. I mean, there are other things that we can do, including, you know, reaccelerating ammunition and
I think Putin would have assumed, if he was told by the President of the United States, I'm going to give you a week to think about this, I think he'd probably safely assume that things were going to be happening during that week.
And maybe they are.
I would hope so.
Yeah, we're just sending such mixed messages. Again, with Vance's comments about Poland, were, I mean, particularly just so questionable to me, especially if you look at the buildup of military might in Europe. Poland is so key right now. I mean, Poland, they're already spending
5%
of their GDP. If they're not the number one, not the number one military in Europe, they are soon to be. Sorry, Nick, go ahead.
No, I agree. I mean, I think that the mixed messages are really diminishing our credibility in Europe and between Putin and Zelensky. And I also think that we're getting very close to just looking a little bit desperate for a deal, because the deal is so much the focal point and not the substance of that deal. And I think that's really dangerous for our standing on the national stage.
Yeah,
I think you're right. One thing I found interesting in the morning reading was Tom Friedman of The New York Times reporting on a conversation he had in Moscow recently with a Russian foreign policy analyst. And what this Russian said was, quote, Trump does not get that Putin is merely manipulating him to score Putin's principal goal, diminish the U.S. international position, destroy its network of security alliances, most importantly in Europe, and destabilize the U.S. internally, thus making the world safe for Putin and
Xi Jinping. Yeah, exactly. And I think the notion, I've seen this written in some Republican circles, well, this is part of this is a strategy to disconnect Putin and Xi Jinping. This ain't going to happen, folks. They are inexorably linked. And I think that we will delude ourselves if we think we're going to do that. There are, you mentioned, Bob, the voices in Congress, Senator Wicker, the chairman of the Armed Services Committee. One of the things Republicans are intending to do in that reconciliation bill is do another plus up on defense, $100 billion plus up on defense, because we are we have serious imbalances in terms of our capacity, particularly as it deals vis-a-vis with China. And so it's going to be critical that we, you know, do not fall into Putin's trap here. Hopefully something is going on, as Fred, you know, imparts behind the scenes in some of these negotiations, because for watching Donald Trump, we know that he often sends mixed messages to confuse and annoy, but he also is certainly cognizant of the history of Russia and the history of Putin. And I think, you know, people like Mike Waltz and Marco Rubio are certainly going to be telling him that and reminding him of that as well.
All right. Good go round. We will be back and continue our conversation when we return. We welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. 15 minutes left with this group, and we'll return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us. Let's see. So we have about 15 minutes left, and I think we can squeeze in two topics if we do it right. And that is completely up to me. So here we go. Well, those poor astronauts have returned. Oh, my goodness. There they are. They've returned aboard SpaceX Dragon after a nine-month saga in space. I say poor astronauts because they were supposed to be there for, what, a week?
Nine days.
Nine days. And they were there for 286.
Sounds like a three-hour tour there.
Yeah, that's
it,
right.
Joe?
Yes, it, absolutely.
Talk about going in circles.
Without the coconuts.
Yes.
For
the professor, obviously.
I heard this, I don't even remember from who, but they said when they went up to space, Joe Biden was the candidate for the presidential nomination. So that's how long ago they've been in space.
You know, what's really sad is one of them left their car in the short-term parking, too. So see how that bill is.
Sunita Williams and Barry Butch Wilmore splashed down Tuesday evening in the Gulf of Mexico. You'll excuse the usage. After this odyssey that started with a harrowing technical problem that forced NASA to swap vehicles and extend the mission from about 8 days to 9 months. Williams and Wilmore flew back to Earth with NASA's Nick Hague and Russian cosmonaut Alexander Gorbunov, who together are known as Crew 9, in a SpaceX Dragon capsule. Crew 9 going home, Hague said, as the capsule undocked from the International Space Station early Tuesday, and ultimately were able to make it safely and what NASA called pristine conditions, and actually moved up their return date because the weather looked better at this point than it would have earlier. I think a lot of things I thought about in this particular story, but I mean, one of them is why now? Like, I mean, because they weren't, meaning they weren't expected to come home until, what was, I think September, am I right on that? Or somewhere. They were still waiting, and there was another plan, and then this one just sort of came up and said, "Oh, we can bring them down. We're ready to go, and this is a fairly routine mission for us, which begs the question, then why couldn't you have done it a lot earlier?
Because they weren't ready to do it earlier. But I think it also shows, again, how important it is to have the private sector companies, you know, involved in rocketry and in space exploration. You're seeing other countries and other private companies actually landing rovers on the moon. This is it's really quite a development that we've seen in recent years, but really great for those astronauts to come home. And it really got Americans' attention, and I think favorably so. So it was a bit of good news that we could have rather than some of the disquieting news that we focus on. But this was good news for America, good news for our space program, and good news really for Sonny Williams' hairdresser, because they'll finally get to be able to give her a new hairdo.
Yes, that poor gravity was not. Yes.
I mean, obviously, the skeptic view is that Elon Musk needed a PR stunt because Tesla is tanking and SpaceX's rocket exploded 2 weeks ago, and he needs something to kind of bring Americans back into his orbit. You did
it
too.
I see what you did.
Hey. and I think it is good news that the astronauts returned, but I also think just zooming out, we have to kind of keep the PR piece in mind.
Okay. I'll give you yours. I'll allow this cynicism, of course. Not that that's up to me. But again, the question is, but they could have done it if they wanted to do a PR move. They could have done it whenever, right? It wouldn't have to have been 9 months after they were there.
I mean, the strategy of flood the zone means you have to strategically place distractions, and there is a scenario where this is one of those.
Mm.
Let the timing of it, not the execution of it.
Fred?
Yeah, this drama, this very welcome return of our two astronauts brings to my mind some basic questions about what does our space program look like? What are we trying to achieve? I sort of grew up with all of this in a family where my dad was an aerospace materials engineer down on Long Island. He designed a lot of the interior materials of the lunar landing module.
Oh, for Grumman.
At Grumman, yeah. He worked on the Orbiting Astronomical Observatory. Dad was a big believer in unmanned space exploration. He said this is where the real future is. But on the other hand, growing up at a time, when John F. Kennedy said, our mission is to put someone on the moon by the end of this decade and get them back safely, that was so inspiring. And it makes you wonder if we really do need a manned element of this to provide that kind of inspiration. I don't really have a firm opinion one way or the other, but I just find it an interesting subject to think about.
And also, that was a important issue for the United States in terms of the Cold War.
Yeah, bouncing back after Sputnik.
Yes, when they lost launched Sputnik in 1957, it was a wake-up call for Americans.
Yeah.
And frankly, given the National Assessment of Educational Progress numbers for our 4th and 8th graders for reading and math, that should be a wake-up call for all of us as well. And we really... the states and the K-12 schools really need to get back to making sure kids are better educated, that they can read and that they understand math, because we will not compete with China. They are developing and graduating so many more engineers and scientific folks than we are. It's shocking. We will not be the preeminent place.
Well, it sounds like we need a national education strategy, John. Is that what you're advocating?
I'm saying, we do need that administered by the states. but one of the things that I just read recently was that the folks who actually run the NAEP, the National Assessment for Educational Progress, that they have been cut severely. And that's that's something that actually needs to be reversed.
Oh, I just want to read this from Ken Bowersox, who's NASA's associate administrator, said that during a briefing this month, after Starliner suffered problems, NASA did look at a number of contingency options for getting the crew home. That included the possibility of sending up another capsule, but NASA quickly decided against it. When it comes to adding on missions or bringing a capsule home early, those were always options, but we ruled them out pretty quickly just based on how much money we've got in our budget and the importance of keeping crews on the International Space Station. Steve Stitch, who oversees NASA's commercial crew program, said the schedule of spacecraft coming and going from the space station, not politics, dictated the timeline. It was really driven by a lot of other factors, and we were looking at this before some of those statements were made by the president and Elon Musk.
Okay. And I will also note that no dolphins were injured in the return of the spacecraft, which
everyone's fine.
I mean, I think there is in that statement and kind of broader, we do have to think about how are we funding our agencies versus the contracts that we're spending money on to privatize those services when our own budgets can't afford to bring back astronauts, but we can contract with SpaceX to do that exact thing. Like, that is the point of DOGE, and that is kind of the, to me, the problem, and this is one of those symptoms.
But SpaceX, I mean, they developed these reusable rockets. Their capacity to innovate has been much faster than what we were seeing from NASA. So I think the private side development. I mean, NASA has always relied, as Fred's dad worked for Grumman. Grumman was a private company, and they developed the lunar lander. I mean, we've always had the private sector involved, and so as long as it's adequately supervised on the governmental side, I think it's a good thing.
But we see that DOGE is intentionally removing those adequate supervision components and reducing or eliminating the oversight bodies that protect the consumer from the private, you know, visionary. It's one thing to be a visionary. It's another thing to have some protections in place so that we aren't sending rockets into space with people on it prematurely. And we're seeing two things happen. We're extending these massive contracts. We're eliminating the oversight. We're deregulating those industries and then kind of just throwing taxpayer dollars at these, you know, private initiatives.
Yeah, and I mean, I'll piggyback off of both those comments, and Fred's comment too, is that you know, I think we made some huge mistakes in our national policy towards space in the 90s when we got out of the
shuttle business.
The shuttle business, and you know, space is an important component of our national security. And you start to think about resources. This is something where I think we artificially set ourselves back several decades by not thinking far enough into the future. And this is something that I think we need to be very careful of with our federal government, is that I want them to be thinking about what the future is, because you have to start, you know, the same comment we talked about, you know, Germany refunding their military now. Yeah, they're late, but better now than in the future. There are a lot of these programs that you need to start now in order to know where we're going to be as a society, where our society needs are in the future, and space is definitely part of that.
Anybody else? All right. Final comments, thoughts, concerns?
Great panel. Great to be with you and our colleagues here and our audience. And keep those cards and letters coming.
Yeah cards and letters.
Absolutely. I just want to quick, we mentioned this, we were just talking about this during the break. I just want to mention that next week from today, we are going to be broadcasting live from the Morton Memorial Library in Rhinecliff, New York. It's a beautiful library right in the Hudson Valley, and we have this amazing panel of superstars, and John is going to be with us. So we are thrilled. We will see you next there,
And the event is sold out. However, if you would like to look and just follow the social media posts and see if there's any tickets that are available.
Scalping?
Yeah, no, we're not going
to. So did I understand you to say, Joe, you're going to have superstars and John?
No, we have the superstar panel, including John.
Oh, okay.
And if I go through the list, I'll blow my my chance of hitting the post here. But it's all there, and we're thrilled to have John and the whole group, and we'll see you on Wednesday. So thank you very much for doing that. Thank you for being here. Bob, always wonderful.
Thanks, Joe.
Be well. Nick, so great to have you here. Thank you very much. All of her opinions are her own. And Fred Hoff, so wonderful to see you.
Great pleasure, Joe.
We'll be back right after this.